Set your computational devices for fun and horror as we take you and yours to 1927, 47, beyond and before. Here in the 1947 Project presents your podcast for today with...
me, Kim Cooper. It's all my fault.
And partially my fault, Nathan Marsack, and our other partners in crime, crimes, and co-crimes.
Yeah, how you doing? Crimebo here. Good to be with you yet again.
Hi, it's Joan. I'm not sure why I'm here. I think I've been kidnapped.
And I'm Mary McCoy, accessory after the fact.
That's right, and we're here again to share with you just a little bit of what's been going on in that wacky world of 1927 on the 1947 Project blog. Yeah, that was a crime in the happening.
That was one of the co-crimes, I suppose.
Yeah, under the table crime.
Cats on the table crime.
So, Kim, what's been happening in the last 2 weeks?
I'm so glad you asked. Well, Nathan, I believe you covered a story about a woman who had a mysterious carving. some artifact.
Is it Thanksgiving already? Well, you know, you'd like to think this was just another kooky story about the Klan. Some of my favorite stories usually involve multiple Ks, but no, this is something else altogether. This involves those cuckoo kajuki New Yorkers. You know, just as I think I pointed out, you all remember when Bela Lugosi met a Brooklyn gorilla. Involving that, well, that's a whole other crime altogether. But it was 1927. It was June 8th, and there was this pretty young lady, Doris Williams, known on the stage as Doris Dore, or Doris Dore, perhaps, but there was no accent grave. You know, if you're going to be on the stage, why would you choose a stage name like Dore, which rhymes with, well, what?
Floor.
Gore?
Bore.
Or bore, thank you very much.
Or lore! Snore. What does Nathan
rhyme? I'm not touching this one.
Oh, come on.
I did. Well, that's... how do you think she got the case carved in her? Anywho.
Hey, you gave it away.
So, when all of a sudden... see, the thing had been this. She'd come from New York, where apparently she'd gone to some wild party, where some... well, let's face it, all New Yorkers are basically subhuman.
Beasts.
Apologies. They're beasts. Apologies to our New York pals out there, but let's face it, come on. You are. And long story short, she met some gent who had her sign some sort of mysterious paper. So she fled New York to come be in Dreiser's, what was that terrible play? American Tragedy. Oy, it was full of all that American tragedy, after all. Tragedeus Americanus, as it's known. And the gent follows her across the continent, sending her anonymous messages and threatening letters. Well, with pen and paper, but that's a type of telepathy, of course. The 1927 kind, before modernity happened, we invented the other kind with the mind and the through the air with the electrochemical brainwaves, don't you know, after the war. And
is this where we're supposed to do the Foley?
That's right, folks. There's going to be plenty of Foley in this one.
It's all later. For Joe.
And so there she is. She's minding her own business. When all of a sudden, night of June 8th, morning of June 9th, there's a Foley for you, you ungrateful bastards. The door breaks down, and there's a struggle with Gorilla Man, the simian of structure, ape-armed beast, and she wakes up in the pool of blood and finds 7 Ks carved in her body.
This must have meaning.
That's right. Well, the boys from Special K, the cereal, which came out that year, are mum on the whole thing.
Ooh.
But M's aside, no, there were no M's, just K's. Well, let's face it, the story smells less like Special K, more like fish to me. And no comments from you about why Doris Williams smells like fish.
It's too easy, I'm not touching that one either.
Why are you even here, Crimebo?
And remember, door rhymes with floor and nothing else, ladies and gentlemen.
Crimebo likes a challenge.
Because let's face it, she'd gone out that night, according to Detective Slaughter, chief of detectives, who was trying to piece together the whole thing, and his name is Slaughter, and yes, that's exciting too. And she'd gotten good and happy down at an Italian restaurant, drinking lots of the red vino there, and apparently insisted that these two married gentlemen had not come back to her apartment. Apartment, or, well, apparently she had an appointment, too, at 1924 North Argyle. Because, of course, all the other residents in the apartment building were complaining about the noise. And the when the Murphy bed gets pulled out of the wall, it makes a distinctive slamming sound on the floor.
How many times do you have to take the bed down?
Well, you like to neaten up afterwards.
Anyway, and then you decide to do
it. You think, you know, it's up for the evening, you go out again, you meet someone else, Good fault, lady died. So, long story short, the last time this happens, last time the bed gets pulled out, there's some sort of big ruckus, a big old fishtera, a recherche. And that's when the bulls get pulled in to investigate the blood and the caves and the whatnot, and that's when this whole gorilla story comes out. A big go-go gorilla. Man, the story's going to thrill you, kind of. Thank you, Axel Foley. And, but there's just no corroborative evidence, ladies and gentlemen. I think she just went wacky on the gin juice from the bathtub. You know, come on, they were putting... gracious knows what in that stuff.
We saw the picture. She had crazy eyes.
Yeah, she had crazy
eyes. All right, everybody. Go on your computers and take a look at old crazy eyes Doris Williams. And she just looks like, well, let's see, what would be the clinical term? She's just batshit nuts.
Oh, Nathan, I'd like to see how you look after someone carves a bunch of K's into you.
Okay, wait, look at this. Look, can we get the zipper noise here? Look at that. Look at that, huh?
And look at you.
Okay, true.
I rest my case.
Very well.
Three K's? Three K's?
That's four short of crazy, ladies and gentlemen. I rest my case. So, gosh, well, what else can I say about this story except, well, it's just exciting, ladies and gentlemen. It's just excitement all over. Seven Ks, and as I believe I pointed out in the story, you know, it's just, I think it's a case of some, does everyone remember when Morton Downey, like, ended up with, like, beaten up by skinheads, but nobody saw it, and he had, like, a swastika on his forehead?
Yeah.
But it was backwards.
Nobody saw that. Huh?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm wondering about these Ks. But maybe if it was a gorilla from Staten Island, I don't know. Let me take a poll. Where from New York do most gorillas come? I want to know that. What do you think?
Brooklyn.
All right.
Bronx.
The Bronx. Long Island. We got one Long Island. Bronx. Two Brooklyn. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to hear from you out there in computing land. Write us in to 1947 at 123 Arcade Station.
And we'll be needing two box tops from Special K cereal with this one.
And let us know where your gorilla comes from. This is Nathan Marsak signing off from Arcade Station, here atop mighty Columbia Tower in Los Angeles, California. Moving on from this gorilla story, I thank you.
And we thank you. Ow! Okay, actually throwing pencils into our eyes. That's for the end of the show. Joan!
Yes.
I'm going to pass it to you, my dear.
And, thank you.
Now you have one of these fabulous stories about a very interesting career.
Yeah, well, this man, I called it A Streetcar Named Attention. Because it seemed like Miss, because I thought it was cute.
Yeah, but, yeah.
And the man in question, his name was Gus Palovac. He had a couple of aliases as well. And he was a local realtor, and he had money in the bank, in a couple of local banks. So it's not clear why he decided to take up bank robbery. But he did, and he got to the California bank on Sunset early one morning and found a United States marshal there. He was waiting for a friend to show up, and he found the bank manager and assistant managers. So he whips out his revolver and puts them in a back room, locks them in, and proceeds to take a bag and stuff it with money. And so he does all this, he gets $4,000 cash, gets it in the bag. So he's just going out, probably to make a deposit at one of his other banks, where he does have money in the bank, and he bumps into another United States Marshal. They look at each other, their eyes lock, it's a moment where, uh-oh, and you can just feel the tension. They recognize each other for what they are, lawman and felon, and boom, Gus takes off down the street, running with the marshal, Duarte, in hot pursuit. And he's running after him, and finally, I think Duarte, I just sort of see him as one of those kind of marshals who has maybe like a little bit of a roll around that tummy, because about midway down the block, he starts to tire out. And he's huffing, and he says, oh,
Okay, so now he knows what to do. He pulls out his gun and fires a couple of shots in the air. Well, at the first shot, Gus drops the sack of money. That wouldn't have been my first choice, but it was Gus's. He drops the money. Second shot, bang, bang. Okay, Gus drops his gun. Again, that wouldn't have been my first choice, but there you go. And so he's still taking off. He's starting to head now for a streetcar. This is his means of escape. He wasn't real thought out on this one, I don't think. So he was going to get on a streetcar, and the marshal fires a final shot, whizzes past Gus's head, and Gus puts his hands up in surrender. And the marshal takes him in, finds his friend and the bank manager and the assistant manager who had freed themselves somehow from the locked room in the bank, and poor Gus, off he goes into detention. Bye-bye, Gus. And I think that's the end of his career, although they did think they had him pretty much to the, you know, they had the goods on him for two other bank robberies. But Gus, I don't think Gus was really well thought out on any of his criminal career because he had robbed the same branch of a bank. And I think Crimebo will have more to say about stupid criminals
a
little later, but he had robbed the same branch of a bank twice. But at least in those bank robberies, he'd driven away from the scene of the crime rather than trying to hop a streetcar.
That's always the problem, you know. It's so easy, you just think you can do it with your eyes shut.
You can hop on, you can hop off, the bag of money, like no one's going to notice. That the guy next to him on the streetcar's got a revolver and a sack of money.
Oh, come on, it's L.A. Nobody bothers each other.
You're right. What was I thinking?
So no one made up eye contact on public transportation.
I know, they're thinking, okay, I'll look away. Maybe he'll get off the stop.
Must be Halloween costume.
Every day is
Halloween. Or maybe he's in the movies.
Yeah, every day is Halloween, I think, in L.A. So anyway, that's Gus's story. But I couldn't find any further mention of Gus, so I think he either snapped to his senses and went back to real estate, or I don't know.
When Gus and the marshal's eyes locked,
yes,
it sounded like, besides the recognition of who they were, each other was, and there was a mutual respect, but also something akin perhaps to love?
Oh, I'd say there's always a little bit of that, yeah. And that could account for the fact that the marshal was huffing and puffing.
I think
as he was dashing down the street. It could have been, you know, a little bit of fatigue, some lust. You just never know.
It's hot.
It's very hot.
And he didn't just shoot the guy.
Didn't shoot him. He made sure.
Would have made a lot more sense.
It would have made a great deal.
Or maybe he was
just
a bad shot.
I think he was not a runner. And not a particularly good shot.
I think he was a man who was just afraid of his own gun.
I've heard about that.
Yeah. They have doctors for that.
Crimebo, have you ever just felt the urge to hit someone over the head?
Daily.
I'm going to pass the mic to you.
I would have to say almost on an hourly basis, but I'll be kind.
I think I'll move away from
Crimebo. Durward Wittenmeyer would be your kind of fellow. He was at the end of May 1927.
We could go bowling?
Yeah. Oh, you could, yeah. You
really?
Could go bowling.
All right, great.
Yeah. The end of May 1927, 16-year-old Durward Wittenmeyer got out of the reformatory. It was he'd been in the reformatory several times. And he got out, and to celebrate, he put on a suit and went to the movies. When he got out of the movies, he got what he later told the police was a fool notion to hit someone over the head, which was just kind of what Durwood did. That was what he'd been locked up for before. He'd hit a woman over the head with a rock in 1924. And so on his way home from the movies, at the same time, unfortunately, what was her name? Fanny Weigel is walking home from her husband's confectionery with a load of bundles. And her path crossed Durwood's, and he picked up some automotive piping or something and whacked her twice on the head, and her body was found. And now there was a little bit of Veronica Mars kind of action going on because the 17-year-old daughter of the police detective was working as an usher at the movie theater, had seen Durward there, knew about his checkered past, and put the cops onto him. So the cops go to his house.
What is she like? There he is. That's the head hitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
17-year-old Thelma Sharp. I wonder what she went on to do, Thelma Sharp. But so when the cops get to the house, they find Daddy Wittenmeyer having a dark day of the soul. He breaks down and he confesses to the police that he suspected his son from the beginning as soon as they heard, read about the body. And he got his son to confess to him, and then he had a moment of confusion and started trying to scrub the blood out of his son's suit. And then he put it aside and then just decided to sit there quietly and wait for the police to come, which they did. Young Durward was found to be an unfit candidate for juvenile court, and so he was set to be tried as an adult. But as a minor, he couldn't be put to death, so the maximum punishment was first-degree murder, life in prison, no parole. Throughout the case, his counsel just tried to make a case for the fact that Durward was not well. Durward was obviously guilty, but Durward was obviously not well.
Define well.
I think I'm putting it mildly.
There was a history of family madness. His mother often had hallucinations and was once found wandering nude in an orange grove.
But who hasn't?
A party, yeah.
Actually, yeah, it does sound pleasant. But
I'll be doing that later.
Some ether, reefer, the E-R, the A. Sorry.
So there's that side of the story, and then the story kind of takes a 12 Angry Men sort of twist when it goes to the jury. Now, the judge really made no effort to hide his bias when he gave the jury their instructions, and they were to return one of four verdicts, which, a couple of them were first degree, parole, no parole. They were second degree, and then not guilty by reason of insanity. So the jury's locked up. After 33 hours, it turns out that there are 11 jurors holding out for the harshest penalty, and one juror saying he should be let off not guilty by reason of insanity. I got that wrong. That was after the first day. After 33 hours, Judge Fletcher Bowron threatened to replace the jurors unless they returned a verdict, soon. However, by that time, the jurors' count stood at 10 to 2. Our Henry Fonda had turned another. And
it's just like an amoeba.
Then, strange questions started to come from the sequestered jurors to the judge. They wanted to know if a plea for leniency would be considered, if they returned that along with their verdict. And finally, that's what they did. I mean, they found him guilty of murder in the second degree, which carried a sentence of 5 years to life, making the boy eligible for parole in 1932. Unfortunately, it sounded like maybe Durward would turn out okay. Maybe he'd get the help he needed. But as of 1949, he was still in prison. He'd been denied parole several times. Although Larry Harnish did a little research for me, and he found his name in the California Death Index. And apparently, Durward Wittenmeyer died in San Diego in, I think, the 60s or the 70s. So he at least got a little taste of freedom. We couldn't find out exactly when he was released.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Story kind of pulls at my heartstrings. Yes, he just needed some help and understanding.
He was very troubled.
He probably died from a broken hip shattered on a discotheque floor.
One can only hope.
In San Diego.
Slipped on a squished orange.
And then, the last of our stories from 1927.
Yes. One thing, though, I just want to point out to our listening audience. Fels Naphtha.
Ooh.
Soap removes blood stains from suits. There's your tip.
Why does he know that?
It's good stuff.
We know why you know.
You need to soap.
I have an entire closet full
of bloodstained suits or Fels Naphtha.
Bloody clown.
A little of column A and a little of column B.
Hi, Kim.
Well, June of 1927 was, of course, the month when President Calvin Coolidge's pet raccoon went on walkabout. Rebecca, the raccoon, was sent as a gift from the citizens of Mississippi to be part of the Thanksgiving dinner. And Rebecca...
No Mississippi jokes.
Who's joking? I'm simply observing. Now, she was actually a very pleasant, trained raccoon. I don't know how they decided that the coon... Maybe they just wanted to make a good showing for the state. So rather than sending some nasty old edible animal, they sent this total sweetie pie. And the Coolidges were big animal people. They were a little weird. Calvin did have a tendency to do things like put cats and roosters in cages together to see what would happen, but they had a huge menagerie at the White House, and they ate...
It was for science!
And for love.
What's the difference?
Right. And in the case of Rebecca, of course, a female raccoon, Cal was never quite able to grasp that she was a woman. raccoon, and he would always when giving interviews.
I don't know where to even start.
He would always talk about my raccoon. He did this, he did that. And in this case, what he did was he got out of his usual enclosure in the back of the temporary White House, and he ran amok. And all of the staff was put to work chasing Rebecca. And, of course, Rebecca, with lots of trees at her disposal, just kept them hopping and chasing and running for several hours until finally she decided she was tired, and she slipped away and went back home. And there were some wonderful photos of Mrs. Coolidge holding Rebecca in her arms. Rebecca is ginormous, and she has the coolest kind of S&M collar you've ever seen. So check her out over on the 1947project.com.
I've seen a few.
And now I think a word from our sponsor.
Jenkins! Yes, Mr. Weatherwax? Where did you get that suit? It certainly looks smart on you. And it was a good value, too. Why, I purchased this from a Hebrew.
A Hebrew, Jenkins?
That's right, Mr. Weatherwax. Well, when I see the seal of Hebrew haberdashery on any fine garment, I know I'm investing in good tailoring at a reasonable price.
That's mining your dollars and cents, Jenkins. Or should I say, dollars and shekels.
That's not funny, sir.
For sartorial splendor, come to the Maya Israel Outfitters in the Mercantile Arcade Building. All clothing stamped with the Hebrew haberdashery seal of approval. So come today for some very nice clothes. Thank you.
Smoke! That's right, you! Smoke new Blodgett cigarettes. They're fortified. With all the good things doctors recommend in the progressive modern cigarette of today. They're fortified with the fibered glass for optimum pleasures. They're filled with formaldehyde, so you may keep young. And just keep. And they're replete with asbestos. For a longer-lasting smoke. Blodgett Cigarettes. Progressive!
Thank you. And now we'll turn to the calendar. It's very important to know how you're going to spend your June in 1927.
Your June?
June.
I spent mine. Well, how are we spending our June of 1927?
Yes, how are we?
Shall I?
Oh, no. What? Where shall I begin? Let's see. Here we have an event. This is a good one. This is good. The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. That's a very good one. Yes.
I like the tongue scene.
Yes. Yes, you would. And the film returns to Los Angeles for the first time. Put that tongue away. For the first time since 1921. And when its screening prompted anti-German... picketing and protest. And it was pulled from the theater after just a single day. Miller's Theater, which has run some really glowing ads to promote the film.
I have a glowing ad.
Yeah. Oh, you did? The glowing ad forthcoming. in the days leading up to the West Coast premiere, ran this on May 9th, 1921.
This is the leading up to. The public. The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, the most amazing picture ever made, will have its Western premiere at Miller's Theater tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Every picture enthusiast in this part of the country will want to see this thrilling and fantastic mystery story which created a furor in New York City.
A furor, you say?
Yeah, I know.
How is that spelled? So.
But shortly they had
those,
to...
those Germans crash. Always creating furors.
Yes. Well, you stay with what you know.
Yeah,
we're good. Well, okay. So we had this leading up to the West Coast premiere, and they ran this on May 9th, 1921. We announced that we would show a picture that would create a sensation in Los Angeles. It did, but not the way we expected. We believed that Los Angeles, home of our film industry, wanted to see what New York acclaimed a masterwork. Well, they didn't. But time heals all wounds, and this time around, the expectation is that Dr. Caligari will be screened peacefully and without incident.
Dream on!
Let's see that happen. So, if you want to, go to the Orange Grove Theater, 730 South Grand, opening June 23rd for a very special one-week engagement made possible by a representative from the German film industry currently visiting the city. I don't know who that is.
I don't either.
I don't think I do. No.
So very interesting.
Shall we continue?
A representative from Weimar era Deutschland.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I love those wacky Germans.
Little known, it was right after that all architecture in Los Angeles was built in the Expressionist style. Crazy.
I get dizzy just thinking about it.
All over Broadway.
I feel a little queasy. Where am I going next? I shall go to June 25th. Lowe's State, 7th and Broadway. The Prince of Head Waiters. Yes, indeed. Yes. Louis Stone. Wasn't he Andy Hardy's dad? Was that Louis Stone? Stars as the noble waiter working at a New York summer resort who discovers the son he never knew he had. That sounds like a heart wrencher.
Stuffed in a hat box.
That sounds scary. Junior has been raised by a proud old family, and the waiter is too ashamed to reveal his true identity. Well, who wouldn't be humiliated waiting tables? I mean, come on now. However, he decides to help him along behind the scenes, rescuing his boy from the clutches of a gold-digging woman. I know. It's shameful.
Thanks a lot,
Dad. How far does she dig?
A gold-digging woman.
Yeah.
Wait, is there another kind?
I beg your pardon.
Oh, man.
How dare you?
Even I would have gone there.
And helping him find true love. This movie also features...
Petter Mamas. The poster said... Petter Mamas.
Everybody knows what a Petter Mama is.
I have no idea what a Petter Mama is.
What is a Petter Mama?
Well, it's kind of like... I have no idea.
Okay, then.
It says... could be a gold-digging woman.
It could be.
In the using context clues.
Yeah. I'm not touching that one.
Oh, go ahead. No, a shiny prize to anyone who can figure out what this means. Exactly what we're trying to do right now.
Petter Mama.
It's
probably a horrible racial slur.
Gigolos?
We're going to get a lot of letters from
gigolos.
Brooklyn Gorillas.
College boys up to no good, like they'd be up to anything else, and a Japanese prima donna named Madam Iki.
Ooh, Iki, Iki, doo doo, Iki, Iki.
Okay, and now we have some 2007 events. I think Kim is going to take these.
Sure, I don't mind living in the future. Gosh, someone's got to do it. Just a few things to share. Of course, on the 16th, we've got the debut of John Fonte's Dreams of Bunker Hill. That's a new esoteric bus adventure. Also repeating July 22nd, a trip into the great downtown novelist John Fonte's psyche in the Lost Neighborhood, featuring his sort of... irritatingly delightful anti-hero, Arturo Bandini.
And delightfully irritating.
Very much so. And on the 19th of June, it is your last day to dine in a 1918 St. Louis Car Company trolley car at the Old Spaghetti Factory. 5939 Sunset Boulevard, I'm afraid to say it is closing down. And on the 23rd, the gaudy contents of the restaurant, including said trolley car, will be auctioned off. Auction starts at 10 in the morning, and if you want to see some pictures... rather crummy pictures. Go to facauctions.com.
Ooh.
On the 23rd...
Is the building actually being raised?
I do not know. This is the first I've heard of it. But
wow.
I did see an auction notice and wanted to share.
That's an old Studebaker dealership?
It's got some radio history, too. It's an important early Hollywood building. And actually, you know, kind of a great place to eat. They have this terrific spaghetti with Misritha cheese. It's kind of, you know.
I've never eaten there myself, but it's... definitely full of a lot of crap to look at.
Oh, come on. I mean, they give you ice cream with your meal. It's
I don't know. Their pasta tastes like it was the original pasta from when the restaurant opened.
What's wrong with that?
disclaimer. We make no judgment on the foods anywhere.
You know, I imagine when a restaurant knows they're going out of business, they don't really bother about hygiene or
anything
like that.
The food is crap. It's full of rat turds.
I'm not washing my hands. I've told you 1,000 times. No,
where
what are you going to do?
Think the real flavor comes from?
On the 23rd of June, perhaps
we
you'll join...
We put the blank in flavor country.
Fully. On the 23rd of June, perhaps you'll join your friends from the West Adams Heritage Association and the Art Deco Society of Los Angeles on a special esoteric bus adventure, Weird West Adams.
Mm-hmm.
Vintage attire is recommended, but not essential. The tour concludes with a reception with refreshments at the Susan Wilshire residence, a private historic home. This reception precedes Waha's preservation meeting on the topic of local history, visual storytelling, demonstrating, if you will, the new PowerPoint narratives the city requires, along with landmark applications. See old photos and ephemera related to Felix Chevrolet. The first 1878 farmhouse in Jefferson Park, a 1902 Tudor mansion on what was then Bankers Row by USC, and a fabulous Craftsman Art Nouveau mansion in Victoria Park, built by Michael Shannon, LA's first traffic cop. And we actually got a private tour of that on the first Weird West Adams tour because the owners, lovely folks that they were, invited everyone to come in.
Lovely, lovely.
Wonderful.
So, Kim, I'm wondering, what is appropriate attire for this tour?
Oh, well, you know, it's largely a Victorian Edwardian crime tour, but those clothes are so small and fragile. I think people should just wear whatever they look good in and whatever they're comfortable in. It's all of a spirit, isn't it?
Certainly.
Pasties in a tutu.
No, it works for me, Crimebo. On the 30th of June, 11 a.m., we're doing our very first walking tour. It's the Dahlias downtown, a tour departing from the Biltmore Hotel at 11 in the morning, encompassing major scenes from Black Dahlia victim Elizabeth Short's time in the neighborhood. And on the 29th of June, came before the 30th. From 6 to 8 p.m. in Long Beach, the Art Deco Society of L.A. again is offering their cocktails in historic places at the Observation Bar aboard the Queen Mary in Long Beach. Open to members and non-members, it is free to get on the Queen Mary after 6 p.m. and the parking is $10. Queen Mary is haunted as all get out, and it's a great place to go and raise a tipple. And and those Art Deco Society people, how they can dress up.
They really do.
I thought you were going to say throwback.
No. I mean, it's just such
maybe
a wonderful...
that too.
They know that that's the crowd where, you know, they can whip out the really special stuff that, you know, you might tear out an armhole while
it
you're...
It might actually what, be what is it, small and fragile, but it just doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, I'll be wearing the SS tunic and fishnet stockings, but that's beside the point.
But you look so good in it.
I know.
He'll single-handedly perform cabaret.
You think you're joking?
I'm not joking. That's the thing. Did I follow it with a ha-ha?
No.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, are those things you can do should you choose to have the very, very bad taste to live in the future. Well, and now, let's have a moment with Crimebo.
Thank you very much. It's now time for my monthly, talks with Crimebo. Alright, my topic this month is, don't be stupid in crime. Rules for getting away with it. Now, if you hold someone up and they don't have cash, don't have them write a check. Be an idiot. If you wear gloves to avoid fingerprints, don't throw them away in the kitchen trash can. Just don't. When going on a robbery, make sure it's not at the donut shop where the cops hang out. When planning a getaway, make sure your tank is full. I can't tell you how many assholes get trapped or caught because their cars run out of gas.
Get a Prius.
Yeah. Now, next one, make sure the window you jump out of isn't above the third floor. I can't tell you how many people get scraped off the pavement because they're trying to get away from stealing grandma's silver and broken leg, broken shoulder, and splat. Makes good comedy, though. Now, don't bring a video camera to tape your crime to show off to your friends on YouTube. I, we're going down the list, and, you know, I'm getting from bad to worse, and that's, I'm sorry, but You do deserve to get caught if you do that shit. Alright. Okay. Ransom notes should not be written on personal stationery. They shouldn't. I'm sorry. You know, from the desk of Herbert Melville or something like that, you know.
What does Emily Post say?
She was out. And, okay. When using a stolen credit card to to order stuff over the internet. This is number one. Don't have it shipped to your home address. Just, I mean, come on. Now remember, there are worse things than getting caught for petty crime. Yep, it could be me. All right, that's it. Moment with Crime Bone. Have a great month.
Yay! Thanks, Crime Bone!
Thanks, Crime Bone! Gee, I've learned so much.
Including some swears.
Yay!
Oh, was I not supposed to swear?
What are those funny words he used?
Oh, wait. I do want to say to everyone, though, for my own... everybody should tape themselves, though, because I want to watch. Come on.
Really,
remember the kids that were like driving down the street and like shooting people on the bus benches with the paintball guns?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
You know, I didn't see that one, but I saw the one of all the guys humping the ottoman.
Yeah, I saw that one.
I missed that.
Oh, guys.
Practice. Okay, I guess that wraps up another bi-weekly 1947 Project podcast. Be sure to visit us. Actually, on the web, 1947project.com, we're blogging a crime a day for the year of 1927 in old Los Angeles, and people are just up to, well, they're a lot like people today. They're just up to no good, and they stink, and you wouldn't want to be near them, but it's fun to read about them from a distance.
Stinking stinkers.
Remember, it's funny because it's happening to somebody else.
Yeah, and it'll happen to you someday. So, see us again next time, and until then, we'll all just say...
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
And how about a little Foley to go?
Don't get caught.
Wow.
Woof.
Salutations, wired and wireless computated listeners. This is Henry Ford. Reminding you, beware the Lithuanian. The Lithuanian lurks within. Thank you.
Buying common stocks on margin is like the raccoon coat. Both are sensible, and both will never go out of style. So, come to McWhorter's Haberdashers and Wall Street Emporium, where you can invest in finery for yourself and security for your future at the same time! Here at McWhorter's Brokers and Custom Tailors, we'll work shoulder to shoulder to ensure your future will look swell! Here's satisfied customer Cy Wengus.
I went to McWhorter's Haberdashers and Wall Street Emporium and purchased 12,000 shares of United Tin on margin. That net worth allowed me to buy a ritzy new wardrobe on easy credit and all clothes that will never go out of style. Oh, plus four collarless shirts, sock garters, and of course a raccoon coat. Why, I'm as level-headed as the next guy, but a zorky shop like McWhorter's makes me say, oh, you kid!
Well, Cy, we don't know about that, but we couldn't agree more! McWhorter's Haberdashers and Wall Street Emporium in the Cutler Building, 7th and Hill.